Hey guys, thanks for listening. Before we get into the pod here, I wanted to quickly just let you know that we had a little bit of an audio issue starting things off with our guest Shamit Dua calling in from somewhere that was a little noisy at first, and we fixed the problem about halfway through the pod, and it shouldn't be too much of an issue, but I just wanted to let you guys know and feel free to turn the audio down or whatever you need to do when that time arrives. Evan and I's volume is perfectly fine as normal, but some of those answers get a little bit dicey until about the 20-minute mark. So just to let you know and appreciate the support, appreciate you bearing with us here, dealing with the bumps and bruises of a, you know, homegrown product. Thanks.
Hello and welcome to Locked On Suns, part of Locked On Podcast. And every day is always your host, Evan Setter, and joined by co-host Brendan Clean. You can follow me on Twitter at eSetter. You can follow Brendan on Twitter at BrendanClean14. Also, Brendan recruited a special guest for us today. You mind introducing him for us, Brendan?
Yeah, we got Shamit Dua over at Bourbon Street Shots, one of my favorite Pelicans writers for a long time. Kind of, sort of wrote with him over at the website for a while, but definitely somebody you guys should be following to keep up with everything over there. How are you doing today, Shamit?
I'm doing great, Brendan. Thank you guys for having me, and I'm looking forward to this podcast.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about over the next few weeks, just looking back on DeAndre Ayton's rookie season, what he's been able to do, what he hasn't been able to do, how kind of the Suns move forward, what he can do to improve his own game. And so wanted to bring Shamit on to talk about Anthony Davis, who statistically, as we'll get into, had a pretty similar rookie season to DeAndre Ayton, had a little bit of injury stuff happened at the beginning of the year, but really came on late and obviously built himself into all NBA caliber player that's breaking the league now with his talent. So why don't we move right into that, Evan? Do you want to start us off here?
Yeah, before we dive into that, I just wanted to go over the numbers really quickly. Per 36-minute stats, I was actually texting Burner before he came on the air about this because I was pretty thrown off from just how nearly identical these numbers are. For per 36 minutes, I'll start here with DeAndre, and he's averaging 19 points, 12.2 rebounds, 2.2 assists, and a steal and a block per game. He's also crashing the glass at a great rate, shooting around 14 shots per game. Then we go to Anthony Davis now, who's averaging 17 points per game, 10.2 rebounds, 1.2 assists, 1.5 steals, doubled Ayton's block production, but he also took one less shot per game than DeAndre Ayton. So they look pretty darn close as far as numbers go in the rookie season, Shamit. But what did you think as far as Anthony Davis' rookie season? Did you expect, what do you remember from that season?
So Anthony Davis, I think, was brought along pretty conservatively by the New Orleans staff at that time. We had head coach Monty Williams, who kind of went out of his way at times to protect Davis from a lot of the rigors of jumping into the NBA from college, because, you know, he's a 19-year-old kid still trying to fill out his body. And so, you know, we didn't see Davis take bigger matchups per se. They definitely went out of their way to protect Davis in terms of matching up against centers. And then as far as offensive responsibilities go, they essentially didn't try to make him a focal point until, you know, a couple seasons in, where the play was initiated by the guards. Davis was assigned what I like to call garbage man duty, which is like, you know, you set the screen, you do the pick and roll, but, you know, you're basically feeding off of handoffs and putbacks and just trying to clean up any messes that get there, not really running, you know, many isolation plays or getting too intricate with the play calls for him. So they brought him along slowly in that regard. And I think, honestly, it helps his development going forward, because it helps him sort of learn the basics of being a big man before jumping into the more complicated stuff.
Yeah, looking at the roster from that season, there's two pretty big differences that I think you notice right away. First of all, like you mentioned, Davis was a four. I mean, he's been kind of intermittently a four or a five, depending on who the other big man is alongside him over the course of his whole career. But especially that first season, Robin Lopez, who Suns fans will obviously remember well. But the other big difference, I think, between what Ayton has had to do and what Davis had to do that year is the Pelicans had, at least to a certain degree, a better guard rotation. I think they at least had guys who could, as you said, you know, initiate a reasonable offense. And I think that's just been huge for the Suns this year. They really just don't have that guy. It's been a slog trying to figure out how to run this team offensively with no lead initiator like that. They had Grievous Vasquez, who was kind of at the prime of his powers. Brian Roberts even was somebody who I liked. I don't know if he was quite at the level at that point. No, not really. He wasn't playing much that year. But what impact do you think especially Vasquez had that first year, making life easier for all those guys, but especially Davis as he got acclimated?
Yeah, Vasquez, you know, he isn't the greatest athlete, and he doesn't have much in terms of foot speed, but he is a gifted passer, and he really helped out Davis because of his pocket passing skills and just being able to hit those spots on the rolls and get easy looks at the rim. I mean, I think as they grew more comfortable as the season went on, Vasquez got more and more bold trying to hit Davis with some crazy lobs in transition, and we got to see some spectacular highlights because of that. But I really do think having a point guard that's, you know, dedicated to setting the table for others and sort of rewarding the big men for their work really helped Davis gain the confidence that, you know, he can compete in this league at the highest level. Not that he needed that confidence. I mean, he's the number one pick and player of the year, but it is rewarding, you know, when you're getting easy buckets because you're seeing the ball grow through the hoop.
Yeah, 3-1 assist to turnover ratio, 9 assists a game, just for the audience. That's way better than what the Suns have gotten at the 1 this year.
Yeah, that's for sure. And especially when you see the rotations we've trotted out, like Josh Gray, Shaquille Harrison, the likes of those guys the past 18 months. But I wanted to throw it back about Anthony Davis and how he just progressed from his rookie to sophomore season. When you look at his numbers here, he improved by 7 points per game. He took almost 5 more shots per game as well, played about 5 extra minutes per game. What was the biggest difference you think that made the leap happen for Anthony Davis going from his rookie season to his sophomore season where he became an all-star for the first time?
Well, I think the biggest thing about Davis is development, and that's not just jumping from year one to year two. It's been throughout his career. Is they've incrementally added something to his game every single career. You know, it hasn't been, hey, here you are, you're the number one pick, go do everything all at once. It's like, no, we're going to slowly bring you along. And from year one to year two, they really just opened up their play calling for him, and they really started getting involved in those pick and pops. And I think that was the biggest transition. I mean, Davis, you know, he wasn't shy to shoot those mid-range shots his first year, but he was decidedly pretty poor at them. I think I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure he shot around 27 to low 30% on mid-range shots when he was a rookie. And, you know, over the course of the offseason, he really worked on getting on his shooting form and getting the jumper right. And you saw a drastic increase in his pick and pop usage, as well as they slowly incorporated some one dribble moves into his offense. And they really opened up the floor for him. They brought in some talented players around him. They brought in Jrue Holiday. Eric Gordon got healthy again. Ryan Anderson was there. This was the first year of Tyreke Evans, I believe. So there was talented perimeter players that made his job a little bit easier as well. And but other than that, I mean, I think they were like, okay, he's ready to accept more of an offensive burden. He's ready to increase his usage. And I think if you go back to Pelicans fans at that time, they were still complaining about, you know, his lack of touches. And I think that's kind of what spurred the eventual change to Alvin Gentry, is, you know, making Davis the full focal point of the offense. But that didn't happen for another 2 years.
Yeah, looking at the numbers a little bit. So his first season, rookie season, short mid-rangers, 10 to 16 feet, according to Basketball Reference, he only shot 37% on those, 26% on the long mid-range shots. The next season, like you're saying, as he kind of got that freedom, had the spacing a little better, had some better playmakers around him, 43% from 10 to 16 feet, 37%. So just a huge uptick there overall. And one thing, yeah, I think that's a key, the ability to kind of grow your own game and have the coaches buy into it. I think both are kind of working against Ayton, not necessarily working against him, but he doesn't have that freedom. He's not really a part of the offense right now. But he also, my personal opinion is I'm not really sure he has the moves and the, you know, ball handling and even the shot making to do any of that yet. So I think we'll see a similar leap. The other thing I wanted to key in on, kind of making our way through Davis's career in the first few seasons, is 3-point shooting. There was a huge huge leap from year three to year four for him. 12 attempts, 2014-15 season, his age 21 season, 108 his fourth season, his age 22 season, and he made 32% of those, which for that type of volume increase to make even a reasonable number like that, I think is pretty impressive. So what do you remember about the Pelicans going about adding that three-point shot to Davis's game and the kind of bumps in the road along the way?
Yeah, so, you know, the first 3 years of Davis's career, he had a pretty conservative coach in Monty Williams, who, again, if you look back to some of the shot profiles of the teams that he's coached with the Pelicans and the Hornets, they were pretty heavy mid-range focused teams. They weren't really high on three-point attempts. They weren't really high on pace. So it was pretty against the modern era, but at the same time, the game was changing, but it truly hadn't made its full change yet to where, you know, everyone's embraced the three-point revolution. And that didn't happen, I think, you know, until the Warriors got on the map, and that was Davis's third year. So, you know, for his first 3 years, Davis just wasn't even allowed to shoot threes. Now, there would be videos in the off season where he would be practicing them, but it wasn't under the first year under Alvin Gentry, coming off of his championship with Golden State, that, you know, Davis started actually taking those threes. Again, it was just one of those things that they definitely worked on behind the scenes, and it took three whole years for them to incorporate it into his game. Now, I don't think that should be the model necessarily for every big coming in the league, but just because I do think there is an importance on three-point shooting in the league now, and it doesn't hurt to start early. You might as well start putting those shots up early in your career and get used to them. But, you know, it's just one of those things that shows you that you can come into the league with as and project to be, you know, a non-shooter or not a great shooter and still make yourself into something that's, you know, fearsome.
Yeah, Ayton took almost twice as many threes in college as Davis did, but has really not attempted a real one as a rookie yet. He's had some heaves and some end of shot clock stuff. So that's worth noting for the audience out there, just to kind of to get a gauge on it. Davis wasn't really known even as much as Ayton is as a shooter, but just how long that took, and kind of even now I feel like there is still some back and forth among coaches. I think Igor Kokoschkov had no intention of letting Davis or letting Ayton shoot those right away, and maybe he should have. Maybe that's something that, looking back in a few years, we'll think, why was he not doing that sooner? But it's definitely something to watch.
I do think there is merit to it, because I think there's merit to learning the skills of being a functional big man before transitioning out into more perimeter-oriented play. Like, I would never want to put a cap on a player's skills and abilities and tell them not to do something, but I do think there is merit in there being an emphasis on learning the traditional things of, you know, setting hard screens, rolling hard, you know, just positioning, sealing out players well, and those sorts of things, you know, working on handoffs. I mean, things that are essential to a big man's game, you know, perfecting them first before sort of moving on, because you don't want to, you know, end up being a player that can do a lot of things but isn't particularly great at one thing. And so there is, I believe, a merit into a step-by-step progression into being a more complete player. But, you know, at the same time, I would never be the coach to say, like, hey, don't shoot that.
Brennan, doesn't it seem like, just hearing these stories, that DeAndre is almost in an identical situation that Davis was as far as his first few seasons, with a conservative coach who lets him go through the fundamentals first, then maybe in time he gets expanded a little more here and there?
Yeah, I think it's similar too when you just think about the kind of personality and ideology of Monty Williams compared to Igor Kokoschkov. I think they're both guys who are pretty, you know, basics oriented, and especially coming into a young team, that's really been Igor's MO all season. So I think it does, and I think it should make you a little more optimistic maybe to kind of hear this story. That's part of the reason I was interested to kind of start to bring guys like this on, guys like Schmidt, who had experience with these gifted bigs early on. I think the one thing, though, is it was easier for Davis to impact the game as a rookie because he was incredible on defense. I mean, obviously not the player that he is now at that point, but had way more of an impact defensively, like you even said, just pure block numbers as a rookie, as a young player. And so to see it not not necessarily happen that way for Ayton. It's like the way he can impact the game is on offense. So I think I get a little more frustrated with the idea that he's being held back there than I would for somebody who had more of an all-around impact like Davis.
Shamee, I wanted to ask you one more question. We're going to our next segment here. It's talking just about Anthony Davis's defense, and you see that's a really big swing skill set between Ayton and Davis. He dealt with his block percentage as far as the sophomore season, and he also was younger and a lot more efficient. As far as defense, what's the big thing with Anthony Davis?
So I think Davis came into the league with a little more I think he has a little bit of a higher defensive IQ. His foot speed is a little bit better. So, you know, some of his physical talents, while, you know, the size is comparable, Davis is just a little bit quicker, maybe has a little bit higher reaction speeds that allow him to be an impactful defender. But even early on in his career, he was relying a lot on his athleticism to cover up for his mistakes, and his fundamentals weren't quite there to his physical attributes. And, you know, I think it was his third year in the league before he made an all-defensive team. And even then, you know, he's improved a ton since that moment. And every year he's added another layer of understanding to how defense operates. So I think in general, big man defense is the hardest thing to learn in the NBA, just because your responsibility is much higher than any other position. And so with Ayton being a rookie, he's adjusting to the rigors of the NBA, the speed of the NBA, the athletes of the NBA. It's going to take some time. And, you know, you look at guys like Tyson Chandler and even like Marc Gasol, it takes time for big men to truly reach the level of where, you know, they're positive on defense, or like significantly positive on defense. But it doesn't mean they never get there, because I think by virtue of being a bigger person, you can impact the game on defense just a lot more than smaller players can. I mean, you can't teach size, but it's something that definitely comes with time. And there's countless players in history that have started off as poor defenders their first few years as big men. I mean, DeAndre Jordan comes to mind, and have really turned it around in the years coming forward.
Alrighty, guys, before we move on here to our next segment here talking about the Locked On NBA Network, I want to tell you guys about their Twitter account. If you're not already doing so, go ahead and follow at Locked On NBA Network on Twitter. I believe it's one of the more valuable resources out there on NBA Twitter. And thinking more about it, you should be following it too, like Vernon and I also do, and our accounts are also synced up on there. So if you're not already doing so, go follow at Locked On NBA Net for the most valuable resource on NBA Twitter.
I want to also tell you guys really quickly about Homie. Fantastic new service that I'm really excited about as I kind of look to maybe buying a home sometime in the near future. And I want to avoid all the needless fees and hassle that can go into that. And that's exactly what Homie tries to do. They are a revolutionary new service that charges you just $1,500 to sell your house. That's $199 to list it and $1,299 at close. That means that on average, Homie customers are saving over $10,000. These guys recently sold a $1 million home in record time and saved that homeowner over $60,000 in commission. Their team of realtors and attorneys is here to help you qualify for a buyer refund, as well as a home loan to make that process of buying your home, your dream home, even easier. To learn more about my friends at Homie, text Homie, that's H-O-M-I-E to 88588. Again, that's Homie, H-O-M-I-E, to 88588. All righty, transitioning a little bit here, Schmidt, to some of the stuff we could watch for this year. I know the Anthony Davis saga with the trade has kind of consumed New Orleans this year a little bit, and it's really made things tough on the coaching staff. But these two teams obviously play. This will come out Thursday, so they'll play tomorrow night here in Phoenix. And one guy that I've been keyed into a little bit this year is Kenrick Williams, somebody that I liked coming out of college at TCU, and he's really ascended into the starting lineup and making an impact for the Pelicans this year after being drafted late in the second round. So what can Suns fans kind of watch for this team in general, but also from Williams as he makes his way through his rookie season?
So Kenrick is one of those guys that every team would love to have, in the sense that he's always positive, he's always upbeat, but on the floor, he's doing everything, you know, you want a player to be in terms of diving on the floor for loose balls, moving off the ball really well for cuts, finding open players for shots and, you know, just rebounding the crap out of the ball. He's a player that contributes in a wide array of areas, and it doesn't need the ball or to score to impact the game. Obviously, he's still a rookie, and he's learning to, you know, battle through the rookie problems, and he's just learning the game as it comes to him. But, you know, there's a lot of promise that, you know, he can turn into someone like maybe Jay Crowder or Damari Carroll in the future, someone that can just is a hustle guy and can contribute. But, you know, as far as the rest of the season goes, I think the most entertaining aspect of the team is definitely going to be the drama surrounding it and how the team tackles the Davis situation and if they want to sit him or not sit him. Right now they have opted to play him the rest of the season and not combat the NBA, not combat the Players Association, and they're sort of playing him 20-odd minutes a game and trying to bench him during some back-to-backs, which has led to a massively awkward situation. And frankly, if you watch the team play, they look pretty lifeless when he's on the court. And it's drastic how the energy changes when he's subbed out and the hustle crew, which I like to call, comes in, which is essentially all the bench guys, all the young players that are playing together, led by Drew Holiday. And those guys are just, you know, out there competing. And I think this whole situation is unfair to them because Davis is not only taking minutes from them, he's just creating a bad situation in terms of the locker room and the chemistry. And honestly, like, the team realizes he no longer wants to be a part of them, so why is he still here?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask really quickly. I know you hinted at there about Davis, just the saga that happened. Just what was it like just when he's like sitting through that with Bell Demps, pretty much sabotaging the entire LA Lakers, and you saw him pretty much quit on themselves in Indiana. They lost by 40 points. Everyone thought he was going to be traded to New Orleans. Just what was that like for like a week to 2 week period just within that city where Bell Demps was kind of just playing the Lakers?
Honestly, it was wild. I think people were still recovering from the Davis trade request, you know, their initial reaction to that. And then to watch all this sort of play out in a wildly public fashion, it was kind of unexpected. And I think a lot of people had fun with it simply because, you know, they had something to root for, which is not the Lakers, you know, to stick it to the Lakers. And so to go from, you know, your superstar wanting out to you nationally kind of trying to embarrass another franchise, I think a lot of fans rallied behind that and they had good fun with it. And ultimately, the trade didn't go through with the Lakers. And I think most of us here in New Orleans are pretty happy with that, mostly from an asset perspective. I mean, you know, it's great to say, ha-ha, you know, screw you, Lakers. But I think it's better that we waited because I think Boston has just a better stockpile of assets than the Lakers' young core, which I just don't find all too promising.
Yeah, along those lines, that's what I was going to ask you next is just, I think everybody seems to be on the same page here, right? You want Tatum, you want the Celtics package if you're in the Pelicans front office. That's clearly what the best option is here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the Knicks can outdo the Celtics only if they win the lottery because Zion Williamson is worth it. But outside of that small probability, Tatum is as close as they're going to get to a sure thing in anything you get back for Davis in terms of return. But also, the Celtics just have a boatload of picks to offer that aren't even theirs, so they'll be probably, you know, less disinclined to part with them. And they still provided some players like Marcus Smart, who are veterans, that can contribute right off the bat and make it a situation that someone like Drew Holiday wants to play in.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by what the team looks like next year. I think if they do get Smart and Holiday as a backcourt is going to be disgusting for opponents to try to score on. So I think the Celtics offer is appealing from that angle as well, like you said. And it'll be funny to watch, too, in June as just kind of navigating like the Celtics drafting players that they might have no intention of keeping and just kind of the, as you said, it'll be the most entertaining thing about
So it's, in my personal opinion, it's not going to get that far. I think the deal is going to be done on draft night or the day before draft night. I don't think there's any team. Yeah, I don't think there's any team involved in this process, like Lakers, Knicks, Celtics, all these teams. None of these teams want to wait until free agency before knowing Davis's status. So they want to have Davis in hand, agreed. Especially if you're Boston, because you want Davis before Kyrie, right? And sure. And so you get Davis, and you know the order of operations for the deals legally going through. Sure, that'll go in after the moratorium's lifted. But I think you know draft night or the day before, you're gonna see a Woj bomb, and it's gonna be you know Anthony Davis has been traded to whoever.
Let me throw you a hypothetical, because I feel like this is actually a pretty realistic scenario that could happen just based off the events over the next few months, and that's if the Knicks don't win the lottery. And if the Celtics, for some reason, if Danny Ainge gets cold feet, refuse to put Jason Tatum on the table, what do you do at that point?
That's a good question. Honestly, you call the Clippers. I think the Clippers have a good stockpile of assets, and I think they'd be interested in Davis. But you try what you can to induce leverage at that point. I mean, even if the Knicks don't win the lottery, you know, the hope is they still get a top three pick. They have, I think, a bottom two record in the league at the moment. And you know, you try to you revisit the Lakers, but I just have a hard time imagining it'll play out in that fashion where it's like the total worst case scenario. But I guess you got to be prepared for anything.
Yeah, that's true. And I might as well add. Go ahead, Ben.
No, I was going to move us on, but I'm down to keep talking about the trade. That's clearly what the people want.
Well, I was going to transition actually over to Jrue Holiday here, just thinking about that. And what's the process with Jrue Holiday looking ahead? Because you hear his comments saying 90% chance, 90% of the reason why he stayed in New Orleans was because Anthony Davis. I feel like he could be a guy, especially we've been talking about this a lot on Locked On Suns over the past 6 weeks or so, that we think Jrue Holiday is one of the perfect fits in Phoenix. Do you think maybe he gets one of the top talked about trade chips this summer? Because I think a team like the Suns can really offer them a top three pick for like Jrue Holiday.
So I fully agree that Jrue would be a tremendous fit next to Devin Booker. I think they're both kind of what they need in terms of backcourt partners. I think Jrue's one of those players that can slide in seamlessly to virtually any team. I know you know he had that quote about the Davis trade request and whatnot, but he's pretty much let management know and people around the team know that he has no intention of requesting a trade anytime soon, and management is very, very high on Jrue Holiday. They've let it known publicly that he is untouchable and he's the face of the franchise. Now, all that can definitely change if a new GM comes in and they have their own vision and they want to go in a different direction, but I do think Jrue Holiday is going to command a pretty high price in terms of, you know, what you can get for him. My personal opinion is next year is kind of going to be an audition for both sides, both for Jrue and for the new management, to figure out if they want each other as a long-term fit. You know, you have a year to figure out what direction this franchise is going in, and then there's still Jrue still has will still have 2 years left on his contract. I don't know the option situation off the top of my head, and you know he will still be a good trade chip in my opinion at the end of next year. And, you know, if he realizes that the Pelicans are going to be in more of a thorough rebuild and not in a playoff situation, then, you know, I'd be happy to put him in a place where he can succeed in the prime of his career. And I think management likely feels the same way. But as of now, I don't think there's any indication that either side wants to move on.
All righty, let's do a quick break here, and then we'll come back and finish up with some more discussion on Holiday, because I'm interested how you responded, Schmidt, when the rumors came out, and I know you probably know this as well, of how big of a factor Davis was for Jrue even wanting to stick around and how that might factor into things as the trade gets done and they move through the summer. But before we do that, I want to tell you guys really quickly about the Locked On NBA show. Make sure you are subscribed to that show to keep up with everything Monday through Friday. Obviously, this Davis drama is exactly the kind of thing that those guys will be able to provide for you. Little bite-sized episodes just like ours every morning in your feed. Stay up to date with everything going on across the NBA. Subscribe to the Locked On NBA show and make that your place to be to keep up. Alrighty. So I want to just hear your reaction to, I know it's not something that was a secret that Holiday and Davis had a good relationship. Of course they did, if Holiday recommitted to the franchise, knowing that Davis was going to be around a little while longer. But how do you think that factors into this when it comes to just his disposition, his willingness to suffer through what might not be, you know, roses and unicorns right away next season, if it is something where they don't get Tatum or the package, maybe it's Zion, and that's not going to be a guy who makes you a championship contender in year one. So what do you think his mindset is, and how do you think that factors into these discussions going through the summer, and if that might make him more likely to be available?
Yeah, I think Drew definitely had a very close relationship with Davis, and it's kind of surprised, like all of us were, when Davis wanted out. But, you know, Davis took the whole team to dinner beforehand, and you know, he told Drew privately before announcing it publicly, and Drew understood as a friend that this is a business and Davis is going to do what's best for himself. Now, that was the initial sentiment. Word on the street is Drew no longer shares that sentiment, and especially after what Davis did with leaving a game at halftime to go do an MRI on a bruised shoulder only to go play in Charlotte anyway. And, you know, to go on national TV and talk about how all 29 teams are on his list, I don't think Drew and the team took that well. And, you know, they're kind of miffed by it, and I think they have every right to be. And Drew's really taken it upon himself to be the leader of the young guys. You can see him before games really bonding with some of the younger players. He, you know, Frank Jackson is someone that he's taken under his wing. He communicates a lot with Jahlil Okafor, making sure, you know, he's ready. He's, you know, being fed when he's on the floor, and he talks to Kenrich. All the young players really look up to Drew, and Drew's kind of taking it upon himself to guide them, you know, over I guess, the next few months. So I think the situation kind of changed, I want to say dramatically, since the initial trade request, where at first there was an understanding feeling, and then, you know, there's a little bit of resentment. But Drew's the professional. He's a pro's pro, and he'll never come out and say that publicly. And I think he's optimistic of what the future can look like next year.
Just overall, I wanted to ask a general question here about Drew Holiday. Just how underrated is this guy? Because it seems like we hear about him in the playoffs when he was locking down Damian Lillard, but he's a guy who's just criminally underrated, one of the best guard defenders in the NBA. He's quietly one of the really underrated scorers now. He's averaging over 20 points per game. Just what do you have to say about Drew Holiday overall as a player?
Oh, he's unbelievable. Again, like, he's just one of those guys, like I said, can fit on any team seamlessly. He doesn't need the ball to operate. He's tremendous with the ball in his own hands. He can play make for others. He can go grab rebounds. And we all know, you know, he's a tremendous defender. He can guard, I think, most 1 through 4. Obviously, some of the bigger players at each position are going to give him problems. But he's just such a savvy defender, and that's what he really prides himself in. And a guy like that, you know, you put him on any team that has any semblance of an offense, and he's just going to thrive. So, and outside of that, as a human being, he's just a great guy. And I really thought he should have been an all-star this year, just the way he's contributed on both ends of the floor. But obviously, the Pelicans' record is just not good enough to warrant a second all-star. And, you know, that's unfair to him, and hopefully he can end up in a situation either with the Pelicans or, you know, with another team where he keeps getting those all-star looks.
All right, Schmidt, I appreciate you coming on. You're the best. You're the go-to for this team, and I hope everybody checks out Bourbon Street Shots, follow those guys on Twitter, and where can people check out what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me at Fear the Brown. Kind of like Fear the Brow with the AD, but it's Fear the Brown on Twitter. That's where all my stuff is. And obviously at bourbonstreetshots.com, you can find my articles there. And also, if you want to hear me on a podcast, we have our own. It's called In the Know. So make sure to check that out. And just want to thank you guys for having me. I think you guys have a really promising future with Aiden. He's, you know, already more gifted than Davis was entering the league in terms of offense. So excited to see him grow. I've been chatting with y'all's assistant coach, Jamil McMillan, and he's really excited about Ayton, and he thinks he's a beast. So nothing but positives I've heard about that guy. And so best of luck to you guys.
I really appreciate it. As always, Shamin, maybe if the Suns and Pelicans ever meet up in the playoffs sometime in the next year or a few years, we'll definitely have you back on.